I'm John Krall. The 19th century writer Charles Dudley Warner famously said, "Everyone complains about the weather, but no one ever does anything about it." Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about why that is. We're going to find out what goes into forecasting the weather. We've got a great group of experts as guests. Mike Ryan, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, Steve Bray, chief meteorologist with Wish TV, and Purdue University professor Mike Baldwin. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits at WFYI.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the science, some cases probably also the art, of weather forecasting. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Got a great group of guests today. I'd like to welcome them now. Mike Ryan, who is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. I'm going to screw that up at some point during the
How are
show.
You, John?
I'm doing fine. It's good to have you on the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Steve Bray, who is the chief meteorologist and also the news director at WISH-TV, just up the street from us. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's good to have you here. And Mike Baldwin, who is a Purdue University professor. Mike, thank you for joining us. Good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot, John.
Certainly. Well, I want to start, you know, almost everyone in America watches, you know, the weather and watches the newscasts, Steve, in particular. And we see the charts with the masses of color and all of that, and we think, okay, we understand what goes into this. We can see what a front. But, you know, I don't think very many people ask the question, how do you go about building the chart in the first place? What things do you look for? What tells you what colors you should use, for example? I'll start with Mike Ryan on that one.
You know, the forecast process is really involved, and I think for anybody that's come into the field as a meteorologist, that's the exciting part of it. There are a lot of different models that we look at that help us build our forecast each day. You know, we utilize on a shorter term scale, of course, the radar data when we're dealing with severe weather, snow, which we've seen plenty of here recently. But we take all of that into collaboration. We collaborate with our partners, not only within the Weather Service for us, but also we rely pretty heavily on the media, you know, with Steve, with the other stations, with academia. We all have a part in this that we work together. And so the challenge is putting together that forecast. And chances are you're not going to be right sometimes. And you know, we're always looking for ways to improve on that, and I think the technology and the science has jumped leaps and bounds in the last 15, 20 years and enabled us to be more precise with our forecasting than we ever have before. And I think it's exciting to see where we're going to go next.
Steve, let me ask, in terms of putting together, you know, as part of your broadcast on a daily basis, when you're putting together the weather report, what things do you look at? Can you walk me through how you build that?
There's a number of things. There's different sides of it. There's the presentation side of it, to where you're building the graphics to support the story, but it's a story that you have to come up with first, and that begins, like Mike says, with analyzing what's happening now, what we're looking at in the future, and how that future is going to change. Looking at those computer models that we have a plethora of them. Some have biases in different times of the year, different seasons, even different times of day, whatever it is.
How can you have a bias about the weather?
Well, we use the term bias. It's a certain computer model will handle different situations better than others. So one may be good at snow forecasting, whereas the other may be good at thunderstorm forecasting. So there's those kinds of different setups that the models have that treat situations differently. And as a meteorologist, and that's where the human element comes in, is that you've got to decide which information to trust, trusting your gut. All of those things come into it to come up with that forecast for today, tomorrow, 7 days out. And so it's analyzing the data of what's happening now and then analyzing what we think is going to happen in the future and understanding how it all works.
What do you start with when you're putting together? Say you get into the office and you think, okay, it's a clean slate. I mean, that's the
right
about the media. You're starting with
something. It's never a clean slate because you're always looking at what the person did before you. Mm-hmm. So we have that constant handoff going on, the morning meteorologist handing off to the evening meteorologist of what they thought the processes were going on and why they forecast a certain way. But you'll sit down and you'll look at data. For the most part, you'll look at computer generated maps of showing where the clouds are forecast to be, data, text data of what the temperatures are expected to be, and then maps showing the precipitation and how that's going to change and how weather systems are going to evolve. So you look at the tight picture of what's happening here and now. You always have to address that first, and then you kind of broaden your horizon and go out and look at what's happening Midwest, what's happening nationally, or even bigger picture than that of what's going to go down the road.
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. You mentioned that you hand stuff off back and forth because you've got an entire staff doing this.
Right.
What happens if you don't agree?
We flip a coin. The coin comes in real handy. You walk that
because
fine line.
Because it probably
right.
would be a bad thing for Channel 8, I would think, to say, have Randy Ellis come on and say, okay, it's going to be sunny and 85 today, and then somebody else comes on and says, oh no, we're getting snow. It's
consistency is important because viewers are watching you and they're saying, we're expecting this, and then if you go a completely different direction. But those discrepancies or those discussions need to be handled on a case-by-case basis because you want that consistency, but sometimes you want the independence for each forecaster to see things for the way they believe it is. I thought it was interesting when you introduced the subject, you were talking about science, and then sometimes you kind of paused, and I wasn't sure where you were going to go. And I thought guess was going to come up or something along those lines. But then you said art, and there is a lot of that. It is kind of an art form, and all these guys have been there to where you see something and two people see it a different way, and you got to decide what you're going to go with.
Absolutely.
And Mike Baldwin, both Steve and the other Mike have pointed out that there have been some huge advances in the technology here that make this, have removed some of the sort of intuitive piece of it, I would guess. What are some of those advances in technology?
Well, the history of weather forecasting is really closely tied to the history of a lot of different technologies going back to the first computers that were brought online after World War II. It was in the mid-1950s that we first started doing numerical weather prediction. And as the computers have gotten faster and more powerful, that's allowed for these numerical models to become more sophisticated and more detailed. But along with the actual computer forecasts, we were able to collect more information from satellites and radars and to actually take advantage of that information much better than we have in the past.
And so you get, in effect, better pictures, clearer pictures.
That's right. That's right. We collect at the Weather Service, National Weather Service, on a daily basis, collects roughly 2 billion individual unique pieces of information regarding the atmosphere on a daily basis, and most of those come from satellite and radar. And so globally we are getting information about temperature and moisture and winds and clouds and precipitation, and that information gets fed into these numerical weather prediction models. The better we're able to do that process, the better we're going to have that picture of what's happening right now and why we're getting the weather that we're seeing, that's going to help improve those forecasts as we look into the future.
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Well, in terms of the technology getting better, is that increased kind of the understanding of the forces that shape weather as well? I mean, is there, in addition to the collection process, are you able to drill down deeper and have a more comprehensive... Mike,
I think so. The example I'll give is the advances we've seen in Doppler radar, particularly over the last 20 years. Prior to the late 80s, early 90s, we were using radars that were essentially built back in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. And there were limitations as to what we could look at. With Doppler radar, we now had the ability to look inside a storm, look at different levels of a storm, and see what was going on, say 10, 15,000 feet up, to maybe give us a better feel of whether the storm had a greater chance of producing hail. How deep might the rotation in a thunderstorm be? And so Doppler helped really push that technology. And then over the last year or two, and here at the office in Indianapolis, we expanded the Doppler radar to include what we call dual pole or dual polarization, which is just basically increasing the abilities of what the radar can look at. We have better capabilities now to differentiate between different types of winter precipitation. That has helped immensely, especially this winter. It also handles precipitation rates better. So, I'm just using that as one example, but absolutely, the technology has expanded to such a point where we can be more precise with those things, radar just being one example.
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Question about if they have any comment what their feelings are on global warming and if it affects our weather, what their feelings are about that.
Thank you very much for the call, Bob. Well, I think we could probably spend the next 5 hours talking about this, but we'll start
that didn't
very,
take
very
long.
Yeah, no, it didn't. Steve Bray, I'll go with you first.
Oh, gee, thanks.
Yeah. Mike, everybody will get a bite at the apple.
You had two mics to choose from. This is one of those really tough topics for weather people to talk about, especially for us in the media. I would lump these guys in as well.
Yeah.
This has been attached to and become politicized in a lot of ways. And therefore,
does that drive you a little bit crazy? Because
it does, and ultimately what it comes down to is the science, and there's science on both sides, and some of it, it's the question of what can you believe, what can you trust. It does seem that there is a consensus on the part of most people that the planet is getting warmer. The question really comes down to a lot of what is the cause of that. And if you bring 10 weather people in here and ask them that question, you may get two different answers,
yeah.
But it may be split right down the middle at 50-50 or in different ways.
What are those two different answers? I'll throw that one to Mike Baldwin.
Well, I think there's a component to the climate that's due to natural variability. And that's always been the case. It's always going to be the case. The other component is due to man-made effects or anthropogenic effects and increased burning of fossil fuels and increased concentration of CO2. The physics of that is fairly straightforward. We're going to have more of these gases that both absorb and emit long wave radiation that we feel as heat, and the more those gases we have, the warmer the atmosphere is going to be. The main open question that I see is the effect of this on the weather, and what we expect the impact's going to be on different types of weather systems as we get into a warmer and warmer climate in the future. And that's a very big topic for research right now, and it's a hugely important question for us.
Is it fair to say, it, to some degree, it sounds like the debate is boiling down to whether, it's not about whether the planet is getting warmer, it's about whether we can do anything about it or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether it's simply a cyclical thing or...
Well, and you have to, and people have to answer the question of, do they feel like we can't, we actually have that impact? Because that's the 50-50 split, right, of, is it man-made or is it climatology or is it natural occurrences? And so you have to answer that debate, because if you don't think that it's human intervention, then what can we change to change it?
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I've got three great meteorologists on the program, Mike Ryan, Steve Bray, and Mike Baldwin. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about weather forecasting today, and my guests are meteorologist all. I'm only going to say that thing once. Mike Ryan of the National Weather Service, Steve Bray with Wish TV, and Mike Baldwin, who's a Purdue University professor. We were talking just before the break about, we got a question from a listener about global warming. And just to sum it up, sort of said, yeah, probably the most of the evidence suggests that the planet is getting warmer. There is a tremendous debate about what might be causing that. And probably don't want to try to arrive at any conclusions here. But I guess what I would start with, you know, one of the things we see when we, particularly when we watch the news reports, and there are a lot more weather-related news stories these days, which is something I'm going to want to talk about with Steve Bray going forward, is that there seems to be more volatility. Is that the case, Mike Ryan?
You know, I don't know if it's necessarily the case of more volatility, more than we're just more aware of it. You know, with the advent of social media, with, you know, the media itself, I mean, we're more aware of these stories. You know, I think the climate is always changing. And what's great with us at Indianapolis at the weather office here is that we have access to weather data that goes back nearly 150 years for Indianapolis. And so what's great is when we have these events that you might claim are more volatile, like how hot and dry we were last summer, we were able to quantify that based on what we saw in the previous record set. You know, we were able to go back and say, okay, in June last year, we had the driest month we'd had in over 100 years. In July, we had the hottest month on record. And really, it spoke to the impacts were similar to what we saw back in the 1930s with the Dust Bowl, which probably the majority of your listeners aren't familiar with at all. This was probably some of the hottest weather that most people had experienced in their lifetimes in central Indiana. And so I guess, you know, getting back to that, are things more volatile? You know, maybe. But I think we're more aware of the volatility. And I think that makes our job more challenging, but also maybe a little bit more exciting too.
How far back do those reliable records about weather go? Well, we talk about a century or so.
They vary, but here, you know, specifically for Indianapolis, they go back to 1871. Okay. And that's pretty good, 150 years. A lot of the record data that we have access to in the Weather Service, a lot of those go back into the 1800s.
But there's also core sampling,
yes,
that takes place from glaciers, Arctic, and that can give us a liar.
Right.
You're taking out a core of ice, and so you can see which years had a bigger ice pack, those kinds of things. So they can track things thousands of years back by doing those kinds of tests. Tree rings, the redwoods, those kinds of things provide an element of scientific record.
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We hear, though, in terms of the volatility, the fact that, you know, the Katrina, Superstorm Sandy, that we're seeing more violent weather patterns. Maybe not here in the Midwest, but in other places, Does that make the task of sort of forecasting what's coming more difficult, Steve Bray?
I don't want the task of forecasting to get any harder than it already is. I don't think that that necessarily makes it tougher on a daily basis. If you are looking at extremes that are responsible, you're still, you know, forecasting severe weather. The severity of that may be amped up, but you're still talking about timing and amounts and things along those lines that are still driven. And it's not like we didn't have tornadoes back in 1850. Yeah. You know, there just wasn't the people around to forecast for those. Now we are. So I don't know that it's necessarily amped up the level of difficulty.
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, we have discussed, you have discussed earlier, just a little bit earlier, about that it is sometimes difficult to come up with accuracy in forecasting. But And we all understand that. There's even a joke about it.
Many.
Yeah, we all know that joke, don't we?
And I bet you've heard them, Steve. Yeah. Right?
We've heard them, too.
Yeah. We keep passing that around out of frustration, I guess. But case in point, Monday, I had a small window of time to get some yard work done and have some help come in and help me. I thought, oh, goody, it's not going to rain. It rained all day. I checked the radar. I checked the written part of it, 0%, 0%, 0%. And it wasn't just a misty rain. It was a rain. And so we worked in the rain. Thank God it was warm enough to do so, and we didn't get sick. But sometimes I guess I'm puzzled because it's so far off. And what? I'm just wondering how that could have been so far off, because it didn't show on the radio. It didn't show it anywhere near Indianapolis and not coming within hours.
I'm wondering what your source is of information.
Okay, I just checked that. It was the internet. Maybe that was the problem. I don't know.
There's a good start.
Okay, then explain to me why, because I go to that every day, and perhaps I should not when I need accurate information.
It depends on what internet you're going to, there's a lot of people that will use certain websites, and I'm going to try to stay away from mentioning those right now. There are some websites that you look at that will be predicting the weather based on computer models without any human intervention. Yeah. And it's an hour-by-hour forecast, and you expect at 1 o'clock it's going to be sunny and it's going to be this.
Absolutely.
Yep. And those are generated by computer models and do not have the human intervention, and that's why we still have jobs. And we hope that our forecasts are better than the one that you experienced on Monday.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks very much for the call, Elizabeth. What are the variables, though? In that we talk about the human element, where do you have to use judgment? And I'll throw that one to Mike Ryan.
Well, I think, you know, the possibility exists. I mean, the models are computer based, and the possibility exists that you could have some bad data that gets into a model, and it could, you know, corrupt the solution essentially. And it's our job as forecasters, you know, Steven and his folks can attest to this too, to be able to identify that and adjust based on other data that we're receiving in. There are times where we have a model that we follow that may forecast 3 to 4 inches of snow and we get 1 inch. You know, why was that? Well, maybe it generated a little bit too much moisture into its solution and it produced more snow than what we were expecting. And so... I think for our forecasters, and we have a number of forecasters who've worked in the Weather Service for 15, 20 years and longer, it's a component of, past events, being able to point to those past events. And when you see weather patterns, being able to adjust to that based on what you're seeing, regardless of what the model might be showing.
Yeah, I would say, too, that, when you push information to the internet that is a direct model output, you're doing a disservice.
Yes, I would agree.
And we want to have that intervention that we run in between here's the model, here's us, and then there's the internet. We always want to be between those two because I think that's where we get. I think weather people in general get bad raps because of websites like that are just model driven.
Yeah.
What are the hardest things to forecast?
Snow.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Winter precipitation type, I would say, because, again, it can be a very fine line on what the temperatures are doing in the lower levels of the atmosphere that can help determine whether you get snow or freezing rain or sleet. And if you're off by 10 miles, that might not look bad, but what about the person that lives in Carmel that was expecting snow and they get sleet instead because, you know, the line went further north? It's all perspective. And yeah, winter forecasting is the most challenging forecasting, I think we do.
And it comes to water equivalency, too. I mean, just a quick note, you know, in a snow situation, you have a tenth of an inch of water. That fluffs up to an inch of snow. So if I forecast a summer day and I say you're going to get a quarter inch of rain, you don't really care. You don't pay attention to that accuracy. Mm-hmm. But if I say you're going to get 2.5 inches of snow, mm-hmm. that's the difference. That 10-to-1 ratio, which can sometimes in a colder atmosphere be a 15-to-1 or a 20-to-1 ratio. Right. So that tenth of an inch just became 2 inches of snow. Mm-hmm. So you pay attention a lot more.
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just wondering, do you believe that the local media weather forecasters over-sensationalize the weather for the sake of ratings? And why don't they say, like, if instead of 30% chance of rain, that it's a 70% chance that it'll be a great day today?
Good question. I think we got someone who can answer that one.
Okay,
I'll take
the last part first. That is typical of most weather people, because if it's a sunny day, we don't focus on that as much as we focus on the next storm, and that's a fault of our industry. We should be at times celebrating the good weather or the 70% chance that it's not going to rain, but we're always looking for where the rain is, because that affects people. That affects when you're going to leave the house, what you're going to do, and all those kinds of things. And I would also turn that answer to answer the first part, which is the media overhyping the weather. There was a situation yesterday morning where we got a half of inch of snow. It was like a half an inch of snow, and cars were sliding off the road. When we present that, we don't come on the air and say, oh, my God, there's a half inch of snow. People are going to die. We try to say that here's a situation. Here's what you need to do to prepare for that. And we try to be respective to the level of severity of the storm always when we're talking about it. But there was a half inch of snow when I drove by three people that were in a ditch. The weather was really bad for them that day, so they might argue that we didn't hype it enough. But we do hear this a lot, that we overhype it for ratings. People pay attention to weather constantly, and whenever we go on the air and do weather, people are tuning in. They want to know about it. And so we're going to do more weather when weather is happening. And so that may seem like over-sensationalizing the event, but we do not go out and try to say the sky is falling to drum up more people watching TV.
We have gotten an email question from a listener named Doug, who says, growing up in the 70s and 80s, when we would get tornado warnings, it usually meant that somebody actually spotted a tornado. Now we get a lot of radar-indicated tornado. It seems a lot of these are false alarms. Does the panel believe that this has caused the public to take these warnings less seriously? Mike Ryan.
I think that's a challenge that we're continuing to deal with. We've had a lot of conversations with our TV Mets here in town, with Steve. I think we've talked about this again and again. The difference, I think, between going back to what the email said with the 70s and 80s is, again, has to go back to radar. With the advent of Doppler radar, we suddenly had access to an enormous amount of additional data that allowed us to make more precise decisions. We could see if a storm was rotating, how deep that rotation was. And it's,
why is that important? You've used that term, deep rotation. Why does that?
Why is that important? Because just to kind of briefly jump off here, with a thunderstorm, you can have what's called a mesocyclone, which is essentially a rotating updraft due to amounts of what we call shear in the atmosphere, wind shear. The deeper that rotation, that column that's rotating, the faster it spins, the greater chance that it could put a tornado on the ground. and the fact that we're able to now look at different levels of a storm and see what's going on gives us a better determination of, okay, how intense is this rotation? How close to the ground is it? And those things help dictate the warnings that we issue. A lot of the warnings that we issue are radar based on rotation, because Are all of them going to produce? No. But quite a few of them do, and we're basing what we're looking on, what we're seeing, are they meeting threshold? Do we need to issue a warning on that? And so how that comes back to public impact and focusing the, you know, with what we get to sending out to the public and everything, it's a challenge because, you know, that's something that we're fighting with. One thing we're trying, and I'll mention really quickly, is an experiment called impact-based warnings, which we'll be starting here in April.
What are those?
Basically, we're not changing the crux of the warning at all. What we're doing is we're adding additional information so that if we do have somebody like a storm spotter, a trained storm spotter, or an amateur radio operator that observes a tornado on the ground doing damage, that we can incorporate that information in an effective manner into the warning to give the public a little bit more heads up and say, hey, this is a higher impact warning. We're not just talking about a radar indicated rotation. We're talking about an actual tornado on the ground causing damage.
Somebody spotted this. We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Keith, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was wondering, I guess this ties in with the idea of sensationalism or I guess the weather and the media where they mix. What are your thoughts on the new trend that is to name every storm, to name every continental system that comes through rather than just the hurricanes?
Good question, Keith, and we've got a lot of smirks here in the studio. So I'll throw this one first to Mike Baldwin, let the other guys laugh.
I guess my opinion of this is I sort of like it. I think there's some advantages to having a name that people can relate to when there's a big event headed their way. But I also don't like it because it's not what I would consider an official entity that is coming up with these names. This is the Weather Channel, and it's basically they're doing this on their own. There's really no there was no interaction with the Weather Service when they decided to do this. The actual official agency that names tropical storms, hurricanes, is the World Meteorological Organization, and there's that the agency was not involved at all in the process of coming up with these names. So to me, it's a little bit of just, again, trying to feed into the Weather Channel's desire to get everybody to watch their channel, to tweet about the storm, and to have some connection to just their entity. But I do see some advantage in again, having something that people can relate to when there's a big event coming.
So it's more like market forces are at play here.
Well, that's part of it. And the hurricanes, the reason why they're named is so you can, A, tell them apart, but also, B, for the historical record.
Yeah.
If I say Katrina, or if I say Hugo, or if I say Gilbert, you know, people that are in the business or even lay people are going to understand what that means and understand what that storm meant to them. The problem with winter storms is the effects that are on people are so varying in degree that I'm not sure you're going to remember a winter storm Bob 10 years from now. And I don't think that you'd name him Bob. I'm not going to give him press to give him a real name. But
I thought that if they want to name the winter storms, we should name them after famous meteorologists, atmospheric sciences.
Steve Bray. I guess.
To provide some historical and educational connection to people in the past that have contributed to the science of weather and forecasting, that's an opportunity lost. But everyone remembers the blizzard of '78.
Yes.
So the real events that have big impact, they get named whether it's official or not, and everyone remembers those.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah.
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I am joined today by weather people, Mike Ryan, Steve Bray, and Mike Baldwin. I punted on that. I'm John Kroll. Thanks for being with us. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about weather forecasting today. My guests are weather guys. I'm going to make this even easier. Mike Ryan of the National Weather Service, Steve Bray with Wish TV, and Mike Baldwin, who is a Purdue University professor. We've gotten a question from a listener who did not want to go on the air, who says, do many weather stations help with the weather and forecasting? I'll throw that one to Mike Ryan.
I guess do many weather stations, that could mean a number of things. In terms of, I guess, extra data that we have, absolutely. You can never have too much data that you're incorporating in. For us, the amount of data we're getting in is important, but also the amount of information that we get from our partners, from the media, from amateur radio operators, storm spotters, that can be during severe weather, verifying a report for us that we think is going on based on what the radar is telling us. That's like gold to us. You can never have too much information with that. And as I said, the more data that we have, I think the better decision we can make, the more information we can put together in putting our forecast together. So.
Pat, welcome to the program.
Hi. I had a question about particularly dangerous situations when they do those for watches and warnings. I know they aren't very common, but I was just wondering what goes into saying that a warning is a particularly dangerous situation or a watch is a particularly dangerous situation.
Good question. Thanks very much for the call, Pat.
Yeah, Pat, I'll go ahead and answer that. Let's start with the watches first, because that's where we can see the particularly dangerous situation. And I think occasionally you can see that with a severe thunderstorm watch, but typically those are reserved for tornado watches. Now, all of the severe thunderstorm and tornado watches are issued by the Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma, and they coordinate with the Weather Service offices. So, for example, if we had a situation where we had they wanted to put out a particularly dangerous situation watch, they would coordinate with us and the surrounding offices in doing so. Typically, when they're putting that out, they see a very high potential, not just for tornadoes to develop, but for potentially significant tornadoes, that the features we're seeing in the atmosphere on that day present the potential for possibly a significant tornado outbreak. At the warning standpoint, we don't issue particularly dangerous situations with warnings, but what we do, and we haven't done that here in Indiana, but I know offices out in the plains have done it, is they can do what's called a tornado emergency. And typically when that is put into a warning, it's at that forecaster's discretion. It may be that we have a large and damaging tornado moving into a populated area. For instance, last year with the tornadoes in Henryville and that moved on into Ohio, I know that was utilized by the Wilmington office over in Ohio, as those tornadoes were on the ground moving into the south side of the Cincinnati metro area. So again, they're very rare that they've been used. I don't think they've even been used at all here at our office. And again, it's that trying to highlight the public impact that this is significant, this is serious, and this is a tornado that's on the ground doing significant damage, and you need to take shelter.
Some of the definitions here, we've actually gotten a listener question.
Okay.
Who says, that's along these lines, that says, what's the difference between the terms partly sunny and mostly cloudy? I mean, how do they, to some degree, because there are degrees here. I'm trying to lighten it up a little bit, but that whole distinction between what's a watch, what's a warning, we were taught when I was a kid that a watch meant that the conditions were there, that it was possible for something to occur. A warning was that it had actually been spotted, it had been seen. Mm-hmm. Is that still a fair?
That's still fair. I mean, as I mentioned, we do issue warnings when we're seeing a significant, again, for tornado, when we're seeing a significant rotation within the storm that would justify issuing the warnings. But absolutely, if we're, if let's say over in Hendricks County, we have a severe thunderstorm warning out and we get a call for large hail and 70-mile-an-hour winds, well, that's going to verify for us, yes, it's going on, and prompt us to issue a warning downstream from Marion County.
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Yes, I just wanted to know if there's are any estimates of how many lives have been saved throughout the years as the forecasting has improved with the technology. So I'll just kind of hang up and then listen to your answer on the radio.
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Paul. I'll throw that one to the academic, the scholar on the panel here, Mike Baldwin.
I don't know the answer to that question. For different events that occur, we will see estimates when there's a big tornado outbreak. I've seen comparisons to similar storms in the past where they've said that there's been a certain number of lives saved, but I don't know an overall sort of summary number that that we could give. That would be a very interesting thing to study.
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Pat, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I wonder about the wisdom of the Weather Channel and the networks placing their meteorologists out in the middle of a hurricane when it's blowing on
yeah.
shore. And the
when they're saying no one sane should be out in this, so we're going to stand out here with a lot of heavy electrical equipment.
Yeah, if you go on YouTube and you look that up, you'll see the guys standing out there and saying nobody should be out here, and you'll see the clips of the guys dancing behind them, you know, half naked or whatever, you know, just to. But there is danger in doing that. Flying debris. There's been close calls at times. I don't know for a fact that anybody out covering the weather in those situations has been hurt. But it is something certainly that we all have to be careful. When we do that, we're trying to give you a feel for what it is like, what it is about, because people want to see that. Weather is one of those things that affects everybody, and it interests a whole large number of people. And everybody's always trying in the media to show things in a new and different way. And that has been an evolution, but it's an evolution that we have to be careful about.
And how much, you know, since obviously you make some of those calls with your own people, what do you weigh in making a decision?
Safety. Yeah, safety. We don't want, you know, there's a strategic way to approach a severe thunderstorm so you're not in the path of that thunderstorm, that you're not going to see the worst effects of that thunderstorm. You always have to be careful of lightning and things along those lines. Tropical things we don't deal with as much, so I won't go into that, but we certainly look at it as safety. We have huge masts that go up that can conduct electricity. We don't want those masts up during those storms, so safety is always the bottom line. We don't want to put our people in harm's way.
We are talking about weather forecasting here on No Limits. Gabriel, welcome to the program.
Hello. I just had a question I wanted to relate to something you said earlier in the broadcast, talking about climate change. And I don't want to refer to it as global warming. I wanted to kind of clear up some of the terms and confusion and really get down to talking about anecdotal stuff, which a lot of people are just talking about weather experiences today. And I think a lot of people get confused. They'll say having an anecdotal experience of having a really bad winter storm and not realizing that when people are talking about climate change, one of the issues of increased severity of storms isn't just that it's going to be big hurricanes or more tornadoes in a year, because there's more moisture in the air. That could mean that you can still have a severe weather event in the winter. You can still have a blizzard or have a lot of snow. And still be experiencing drought conditions like we are this year. And I just wondered if there's if that's something that can be in the debate, or how you guys would relate that. Do you deal with confusion where people kind of assume like this is a bad storm, or we've had storms in spring, or we've had storms in this type of part of the year, and then they assume it's not going to be the same type of weather, it'll be worse or better.
I would kind of equate it to something that a few years ago there was, you know, El Nino. El Nino was in the news, and so every storm that came out or everything was blamed on El Nino.
Yeah.
You know, it's really hard to have that anecdotal evidence that says this is a result of climate change. And so it's difficult to be able to definitively tag that on bigger storms or even droughts. A lot of these are things that people talk about when they're talking about the future, you know, of climate change, that we're going to go into these kinds of patterns. And then when they show up, there's certainly that correlation. But it's really hard to say this storm was enhanced more brutal, anything along those lines, because of climate change. It's really hard to draw that direct correlation.
Yeah, and just to add to what Steve says, I think there's a natural tendency to begin with that whenever you have some big storm that's impacted a lot of people, at least with climate change, it is to say, oh, this must be because of some of the things with climate change. And that's really difficult. It's dangerous to apply that to just one event. You know, we had that with the drought last year, with the severity of the drought and the heat. And one thing we explained when you went back and looked at some of the record data and some of the things that were going on, well, there were a number of factors that contributed to the drought last year. Case in point, on this day last year, March 14th, we had a record high of 81 degrees, which would feel really nice today. And that started a string of having 7 days above 80 degrees in March in Indianapolis. That had never happened before in the 150 years of record. We had a very warm March, which led into a warm, dry spring, which culminated with an exceptionally hot, dry summer, at least through early August. And those things, the fact that we were drier during essentially our wet time of the year, during the spring, as well as how dry things were out to the south and west of us and other atmospheric patterns, contributed to the severity of the drought that we had last year. And so trying to quantify that, you know, is a challenge for us. And I know it's a challenge for Steve and the media folks, and I'm sure it's a challenge in academia as well for Mike.
Well,
we don't want to diminish climate change at all, because it is a very important topic to discuss, debate, and hopefully eventually address.
Mm-hmm. And discussing really what the cause is, which seems to be, you know, where a lot of the debate is it possible to talk a little bit about what some of the impact of this warming might be, Mike Baldwin?
Well, just to go back to what the caller's question was, I think, alluding to, is some of the impacts of this global warming or climate change might be counterintuitive. And I think there's been some evidence that the melting of the sea ice over the North Pole that we've been seeing getting worse and worse over the past several years actually will have a pretty big impact on the winter weather, where that sea ice it melts and we end up with a very warm, at least relatively speaking, polar region, and that disrupts the typical jet stream flow that sets up in the winter, where we usually have a very strong west to east jet that goes around the pole. Instead, we have this sort of abnormal high pressure that sets up, and we saw that this winter over Greenland, where instead of having east to west flow, we have a lot of south to north flow. And with that jet stream being disrupted, what actually happens is we get this north to south flow over the U.S. and Canada, and that ends up bringing colder air than we might otherwise expect during the winter season, and more snowfall. I think that's pretty consistent with what we saw for this particular winter. And so global warming doesn't mean that we're not going to have winter anymore. It doesn't mean it's just going to get warmer and warmer. The impact and the changes that we're going to see are probably going to be somewhat counterintuitive in a lot of situations.
We've gotten an email question from a listener that's a little quirky. Is the Farmer's Almanac something that meteorologists still use? I got through it that time. If not, how accurate is the Farmer's Almanac with today's technology, and what does the almanac use for its predictions?
We use it for a door jam.
Yeah.
sorry, that was mean.
Okay, well, I think we know where the next call is coming from. The publishers, I'm pretty sure, but that's okay.
We did a story on it a few years ago where we actually went back and we looked at the data from what was predicted from the Farmer's Almanac to what actually happened, and there was very little commonality between the two. They do talk more about what they call teleconnections. Mm-hmm. A lot of the last few versions of the Farmer's Almanac have come out, and they've talked about this global patterns, and that's where they come up with a lot of their forecasts. And that's where a lot of long-range forecasters come up with their forecasts of what's going to happen. But I don't necessarily believe in the Farmer's Almanac version, you know, as a source of the best data for
I would second Steve's comments on that, yeah. It's, you know, and I don't really know, like you said, how they put it together. It's interesting that they have more global data and teleconnection data, but, you know, long-range forecasters can make those forecasts going out 3, 6, 9 months, but that's not taking into account the weather patterns that may, like for instance, a summer forecast. The weather patterns that may crop up during the spring will have an impact on what happens that summer. As you get closer to an event, your confidence, you know, increases. Grows in what that forecast
so
is going to be.
On your average long-range forecast, what's the degree of confidence in that? 50%?
I don't know if there's a specific percentage we can put to it. You know, I think most certainly our for the Weather Service folks, I mean, we focus on 7 days and 3 days, and you focus kind of your greatest energies on the 3-4 days, and then beyond as you get further out, and then you're looking at a week, 2 week period, and again, based on global phenomena and what's going on, we can make a pretty good determination on that. For instance, for folks who are looking for spring, I've got bad news. I don't see any sustained warmth over the next week or two here in central Indiana, and it's because what Mike had said, we're kind of in a stagnant pattern right now, and we've got low pressure in the upper levels of the atmosphere over the eastern U.S., and it's enabling cold air to continue to funnel down, and we're getting these little shots with light snow and rain, and that pattern doesn't really look like it's going to change much over the next week or so.
And it's interesting when you look at long range. You know, there's a growing business out there for stock market analysts who are meteorologists. We did a story about one up in Chicago that basically talking about futures of natural gas, and they do long-range forecasts, and there's money involved in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see where that goes. You know, if you are forecasting
a whole other ethical dilemma for you guys.
Yeah, you bet.
What you project. This conversation's taken us into places that I couldn't have anticipated. Is it safe to say, though, the fact that we've had a fairly cool spring means that we're not likely to have a drought and the kind of record highs that we did last summer?
Well, it's interesting because if you look ahead to the summer, we're forecasting greater chance for above normal temperatures, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have the drought issues. I think it is safe to say, considering the fact that the drought conditions across the central U.S. are not nearly as pronounced now versus this time last year, and the fact that we are having a cooler start to the spring, more than likely we're not going to see a summer on par with what we had last year. Could we see periods with hotter, dry temperatures? Sure, but that's part of the summer.
That's going to have to be the last word. I want to thank all of you for joining me. I'd like to thank my guests, Mike Ryan, Steve Bray, and Mike Baldwin for joining us. You have been listening to No Limits. We will be back next week. I am John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Allseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.